Jay Krishnamurti, at the outset of his life's work some 40 years ago, said that his only concern was to set men absolutely, unconditionally free. Krishnamurti began to speak along his present lines in 1929, when he repudiated all connections with organized religions and ideologies. Since that time, Krishnamurti has continued to travel the world, speaking, discussing, and writing. He is the author of many books, among them The Awakening of Intelligence, The Urgency of Change, Freedom from the Known, and The Flight of the Eagle. This is the third in a series of four talks given at San Diego State University.
I would like, if I may, this evening, talk about the implications of meditation and what is necessary for a mind that is capable of really true meditation. What is the first step, as it were? First of all, I think one has to understand the meaning of the word freedom. For most of us, freedom implies freedom to express ourselves or freedom to do what we like in society or freedom to think what we like or freedom from a particular tiresome habit or a particular idiosyncrasy, and so on. To understand what is freedom, because that is, it seems to him, absolutely necessary for a mind that's capable, without any distortion, to be able to meditate. For most of us, we demand freedom politically or religiously or to think what we like. And there is a freedom of choice. Political freedom is all right, and one must have it. But for most of us, we never demand and find out whether it is at all possible to be free inwardly. Our mind is a slave to its own projections, to its own demands, to its own desires and fulfillments. The mind is a slave to its cravings, to its appetites. And apparently, we never ask whether it is at all possible to be free inwardly. But we are always wanting freedom outwardly. to go against the society, against a particular structure of society. And this revolt against society, which is taking place all over the world, is a form of violence which indicates that one is concentrating on an outward change without the inward change. So, violence plays an extraordinary part in our life. We're never asked whether the mind can be completely and utterly free from violence. We have accepted it as part of life, as we have accepted war as the way of life. And we have our favorite wars. You may not like this particular war, but you don't mind having other kinds of wars. And there will be always wars, and there have been for 5,000 years wars, because man has accepted violence as the way of life. And we never question whether the mind can be really and truly, deeply, be free of violence. And the permissive society in which we live, the culture in which is gradually coming out of this society, to do what one likes, or choose what one likes, is still an indication of violence. Where there is choice, there is no freedom. Choice implies confusion, not clarity. When you see something very clearly, there is no choice, there is only action. It's only a confused mind that chooses. And choice is an indication of the lack of freedom. And therefore, in choice, there is resistance, conflict. And so, our life as it is now is based on violence. Our life is conditioned by the verb to be. Please, this is important to understand. How our life is guided and conditioned by the verb to be. One has been, one is, and one will be. The idea in that verb is to arrive, to succeed, to achieve, to become. Gradually attain peace, gradually get rid of the things that hinder us. So the verb to be is the conditioning of the mind in time. Right? Do please follow this. Because enlightenment is not a matter of time at all. Understanding is not a matter of gradual sensitivity. Either one understands it immediately or not at all. And as long as the mind is conditioned by that verb, and as most minds are, all our moral structure is based on that. I will be good. I will gradually achieve a certain state of mind, and so on. So, one has to be aware of this dangerous word and find out whether the mind can be free of word. Because the word is never the thing. The description is never the described. And yet we are satisfied with the description, with the explanations. So, as I said, we are going to go into this question of not only what is meditation, and I believe that's a new word that you have learnt in this country, brought from the East. And one doesn't know the full meaning of that word. But before we go into that, which is a very complex and the most important thing, meditation. It's the most beautiful thing in life if you know what meditation is. But before one can meditate, one must understand what is living, what is love, and what is death. If you don't understand that, your meditation is merely an escape. It is a form of self-hypnosis. Right? So you must lay the foundation. Not gradually. There must be order. For the mind can fully comprehend the significance of what meditation is. There must be complete order, which means the end of all conflict, all disturbance, all disorder within oneself. Otherwise, you are sitting down in a corner by yourself for 10 minutes a day and thinking you are going to meditate or achieve enlightenment is nonsense, if you don't mind my saying so. So one has to understand what living is. And one can understand that only by observing what actually it is. Not opposition to a concept, to a formula, to an ideology, but actually what it is. So one must be free to observe actually what our life is, not what it should be. If you are thinking in terms of what it should be, then you are totally avoiding what actual life is. So what is this life that we are living? This life, the actual daily life, is disorder. Isn't it? There's conflict. There is driving ambition. There's battle in ourselves, opposing contradictory desires and wills. Endless frustrations. And there is frustration because we've never understood what fulfillment is, and if there is such thing as fulfillment. What is there to fulfill? One's own particular little ambition? One's own appetites? Envies, ambitions to be somebody? And what is it that center that demands all this? Is not that very center the cause of disorder? And without bringing about order in that life, complete mathematical order, life has very little meaning. Going to the office every day for the rest of the 60 years, or 40 years, living in this constant battle between what is and what should be, between the frustrated ambitions and the simple, clear, beautiful life. The images that one has built about oneself and about others. The self-centered activity that's going on all the time, which is isolating each one. And therefore dividing. And that's our life. A life of conflict, a life that has really no meaning as it is. A life that is a battlefield, not only in yourself but also in your relationship. A life of division, contradiction, routine, monotonous, and a life that is, when you look at it very deeply, utterly lonely. A life that has no beauty. And that is our life. And we are not exaggerating it. If you observe yourself very carefully, without any prejudice, bias, when you look at every human being right through the world, the saint, the priest, the specialist, the careerist, the ordinary layman, are all caught in this. And we want to escape from it. And so you escape through nationalism, through beliefs, through dogmas, through innumerable forms of entertainment, in which is included the religious entertainment. That's our life. Comparing ourselves with something that should be, comparing ourselves with the greater, with the nobler, with the more intelligent, with the more spiritual, and so on and on and on. Therefore, conflict and fear. This is our life. A battle for security, and in the very search of security, psychological as well as physical, will bring about destruction. These are obvious facts. And from this we want to escape, because man has lived like this for thousands and thousands of years, with sorrow, confusion, and great misery and mischief. And without changing all that completely, radically, mere outward revolution, changing a particular system for another system, does not solve this aching agony. There is only one revolution, the inward revolution. So, spitting on society, blaming society for your condition, is obviously blaming something which you have created. It's your society. You have built it. By your greed, envy, ambition, competitiveness, comparison, by one's own and inward hatreds, violence. So that is our life, really quite insane life. Now, the question is, how can that life be changed? Not gradually, but immediately. Otherwise, you're sowing the seed of violence. Though you may want peace, you're actually sowing the seeds of enmity, misery. So, in all this, non-verbally, not as an explanation, not as an idea, but seeing it actually as it is, feeling it as you feel hunger. Therefore, being intimately related to it. And you cannot be deeply, beautifully related to this living, which we call life, as long as you have any form of escape from it. Any form of distortion. So, awareness without choice to be aware of this whole phenomenon of existence. Not someone else's existence. Not being aware of this, of our life according to somebody, some philosopher, some guru, some psychologist, but being aware of it actually, because you yourself see it. One is so completely aware of it, and one must, because one cannot possibly live as we are living. We are talking inwardly, psychologically, a life that's torn. And if we want order and order is virtue, order demands discipline, that is to learn not to conform, not to imitate, but to learn, and to learn about the disorder, which is our life, to observe it, to learn. And in that observation comes an extraordinary discipline, not imposed by anybody, because the very observation itself has its own discipline. In the very act of observing, you are learning, and therefore the learning is the discipline. Please do see this, because we have imposed upon ourselves so many disciplines. The business discipline, the religious discipline, the family discipline. Of course, the military discipline is the most absurd kind of discipline. But we have got so many disciplines, the must and the must nots. Always conforming, imitating, suppressing, and being suppressed, wanting to fulfill. All that is disorder. So, to understand order, to learn about order, not what order should be. But to learn about it, one must learn about disorder. Right? Are we following each other? Or are you being slowly being mesmerized by words? Well, if you are Thorpe, it's up to you. We said one must learn about disorder, which is our life, which is our mind, our heart, our very core of our being is disorder. Because if you say there is a soul, there is the, according to the Hindus, the Atman and so on, they're just theories. Philosophy has nothing to do with living. And we're trying to understand what living is. And we see in that living there is disorder, utter disorder. The battle, the misery, the confusion, the agony, the guilt, the fear. So one has to observe, without any choice, this disorder which is you, which is me, to observe it, not what you want it to be. Then you create conflict between what is and what should be. And where there is conflict, there is disorder. Please do understand this thing very simply. Once you understand this, you will find that by observing disorder in oneself, without any distortion, without wanting to bring about order out of this disorder, trying to impose what you think is order upon disorder, but observe it without any choice, without any distortion, then out of that observation comes supreme order, the highest good. And in that there is a total revolution, and from that inward radical change, then there comes outward order, not the other way around. We want outward order first, and it's never been possible. Every revolution, including the communist revolution, said, forget about the inward order. Let's have state order. And you know what's happening. Every revolution has done this. Try to bring about outward order without paying any attention whatsoever to the psychological supreme order within oneself. And order means also not only virtue, but love. And what is love? I wonder if you ever asked that question, what love is. Have you? What is love? How will you find out? Only you'll find out what it is through what it is not. Through the through negation, the positive comes. But if you pursue the positive, then it is the pursuit of the projection of the mind. So when you deny all the projections of the mind, by denying in a sense, setting it aside, negating, then you'll find out what it is. So that's what we're going to do. Find out what it is not, to find out what it is. Is this, can we go on? Right. We said, what is love? You know, that's one of the most important things in life. If one has love, you can do what you like. Then there is no conflict. Then there is no evil. There is great bliss. But do you imagine what bliss is and pursue that? It's not love. So we're going to see what it is not and therefore come upon what it is. Therefore it's not a question of searching out love, nor cultivating love. How can you cultivate love? All cultivation is the product of the mind, product of thought. It's like a mind that pursues humility. It says, I know vanity and I must cultivate humility. And when the mind that's proud and vain cultivates humility, it is still vain. It's like those saints that are pretending to be humble because they have cultivated humility. So what we're going to do is to find out what it is not. Not through me, not through the speaker at all, but by listening to yourself and finding out what it is not, and what, if it is not that, to wipe it away instantly. If you don't wipe it, if it doesn't disappear, then you are caught in time. You are a slave to the word and the verb to be. Therefore there is no love. So first we are asking what it is not. Obviously it is not jealousy. It is not envy. And your love is hedged about a prisoner to jealousy, envy. Right? And when you see that you are, what you call love is entangled with the ugly brutality of jealousy, see it, actually observe it. And in that observation, jealousy goes, and you will never be jealous again. Never envious. Please do this as we are talking. Envy comes only when there's comparison. And is love comparison? So, again, you put aside all comparison, which means all envy. Then, is love pleasure? This is going to be a little more difficult. For most of us, love is pleasure. Whether it's love, sexual love, or love of God, or love of God knows what else. It's based on pleasure. The love of respectability is the very essence of the bourgeois mind. So, is love pleasure? Do observe it, please. We were saying yesterday evening what pleasure is, the product of thought. Having had pleasure of different kinds yesterday, you think about it, you have image upon image built. And that stimulates you, and that gives you pleasure, sexual or otherwise, and that you call love. And is it love? Because in pleasure, there is frustration, there is pain, there is agony, there is dependency. Don't you depend psychologically on another? And when you do, and you depend on your wife or your husband, whatever it is, and you say, I love you, is that love? And in that dependence, is there not fear? You're the product of your conditioning. You're the product of your society. You're the product of propaganda, religious and otherwise. For 2,000 years, as in India, 10,000 or 5,000 years, they've been told what to believe, what to think. You repeat what others have said. All your education is that, the repetition of what you have learned from a book. And you're that. You're conditioned. You're not free, happy, vital, passionate human beings. You're frightened human beings and therefore second-hand. You're full of authority of others. Or your own particular little authority. Of your own knowledge, you know something about something and you become an authority. So you're not free. And intellectually, look, are you free? Not repeat what others have said. Not what you have been taught in the university, or what you have learned from a book. And what have you experienced? Go into it, you will see what you have experienced. You You have experienced something that you can always recognize. Otherwise, it's not an experience. Therefore, your experience is always old. Like thought is always old. Thought is never new. Because it's a response of memory. So you, if you will forgive my repeating it, you're second-hand human beings. Intellectually, emotionally. You go to places to learn how to be sensitive. Lovely idea, isn't it? Be taught by another how to think. So, morally, intellectually, deeply, you're not free, and therefore you're only free in your sexual expression. And that's why it has become so extraordinarily important. There you are, full. There you're free. Though it has its own problems and its own neurotic attitudes and actions. So sex becomes important when everything else becomes unimportant. When life, the whole of it, not just sex, life includes living. Life includes what love is, what death is. The whole movement of living. When that has no meaning, then one fragment which you call sex becomes extraordinarily important and vital. When you're not passionate about freedom inwardly, then you're lustfully passionate about sex. That's all. And with that, you associate love. Pleasure. And with that, you associate tenderness, gentleness, maybe sexually very tender, very kind, considerate, but outwardly you destroy, you kill everything around you, animals, to eat. To hunt. So your love is based on pleasure. And therefore, is it love? Love surely is something none of all this. Compassion means passion for everybody. Not to a particular little desire. So, when you understand what disorder is by observing very closely, out of that comes order. And order has its own discipline, which is its own virtue. Therefore, that order is the supreme good and therefore love, which has nothing whatsoever to do with pleasure. But pleasure has pain. Love is enjoyment. Love is joy. not the puny thing that one man has made it. And to find that out, what love is, you must also understand what death is. Right? Do you really want to understand what death is? Yes? I doubt it. Very much. Because you're all so scared of death. Aren't you? Or you have a belief in afterlife. Therefore you are not frightened. You have rationalized your life, knowing that it's going to come to an end, the puny, shoddy little life that one lives. And everyone is frightened of that. Therefore, say, let's rationalize it, think about it, clarify it, you know, all the rest of it. Or you have a belief in the afterlife. The whole of Asia believes in afterlife. Millions believe in reincarnation. But they never question what it is that incarnates. They believe that there is a permanent entity that's going to incarnate. And so on. I won't go into all that. If you believe in reincarnation, then what matters is how you live today. Right? Because you're going to pay for it next life. How you live, what you do, what you think, what your morality is. So, even though you may believe in reincarnation, what matters is how you live now. So you have to face death. Not postpone it till old age, some accident, disease, and so on. You have to meet it, you have to understand it. Not be afraid of it. So we say, we must understand life and avoid death. But if you see life as a whole in which there is this living and this extraordinary thing called love and death as a total unit, not three separate things, then what is death? The organism, by usage, disease, and all the rest of it, comes to an end. It comes to an end quicker when there is conflict. All your heart failures and all the business of it is the result of this extraordinary, emotional, contradictory way of living. The organism comes to an end. And either you can say, that's the end of it, finished. Or, which we don't say, the end of the whole structure and the nature of the me. The me, which has divided itself as us and they, we and those, we and you, that me is the center of conflict. Now, can that me die. Not eventually, but every day. Then you will know what death is, so that the mind is always, tomorrow it's fresh because it has, you have death to the past. Are you following all this? No, sir, do it, not follow it. Die to your pleasure. Die to your furniture. And that's what you are, your furniture. Whether the chair or the furniture that you have accumulated in your mind, which you call knowledge. So that you die every day to everything that you have accumulated. And that's what's going to happen to you anyhow. That means to empty the mind of everything known, which means the mind becomes utterly innocent. And it is only such a mind that has this extraordinary religious quality of purity that can come upon what is called enlightenment.